Viola Williams, Veal 17. So after Korea, were you still working with the WYWCA?
Yes, I came back to England, and I did a year up in the north on when they were slum clearing after the war. The government was a strong move to rehouse people, and there were a tremendous lot of housing estates going up in the north. And I was given a caravan, which was made into a mobile kitchen. And I went round, to start with, it was round the Sheffield one, the new estates around Sheffield, stopping in sort of, because a lot of those new housing estates were completely soulless affairs. There was no church, no shops, no schools, they were just houses with people in them. And the people, it wasn't like coming out of the slums where they knew everybody, and probably even their relations were down the road. These were people who'd been transported into new houses, which were very nice little houses, and they didn't know their neighbours on either side. They didn't know any class hierarchy, which also made life a bit difficult for some of them. And my job there was to try and break down some of the inhibitions, do some cookery demonstrations, do some advisory work, get some of the kids together. I had quite a good Saturday morning program there, which with the children, which also brought the parent, the mothers in to see what their children were doing. So that worked out quite well. And gradually I got a couple of clubs going where they ultimately took over themselves and ran themselves. And I was quite pleased. I went back about 10 years afterwards, and at their invitation to for one of them was having a 10th anniversary party, and they asked me if I could go. Luckily I was in the country at the time, and I did go out, and we had a lovely time, because they did say that it had made quite a difference being able to get to know some people through an agency like us being there. So I think that was quite useful. I also did one or two around Stockton. I went on to Stockton afterwards. But that was not quite so successful. It was too close to Manchester, and they were more involved in Manchester than they were in trying to be involved themselves. But the Sheffield one, I think worked, and I think it's very necessary. And it's interesting that recent housing estates nearly always do try to get some form of a focal point in them, because that was the great miss there, was that there was no focal point. Like a village grew up with the pub or the the post office or a local shop, but there was nothing there. They were mostly fairly young. Some of them were older, but most of them were fairly young children. And they were just isolated in their little houses, and it was good. I enjoyed it. I only did it for a year, but it was good while it lasted.
And that would have been the post-war rehousing,
post-war building. Yeah.
Yes. Did you have much to do with prefabs post-war in that sort of setting?
No, these were proper houses.
They were.
Proper houses. Yes. I know there are still some prefabs from the war. I think it's Upavon in Wiltshire. There's a whole little estate there still of prefabs, and they've been very well maintained, and the people are very happy in them. I think it's Wiltshire, near Upavon. But no, this was all proper building. I wouldn't go so far as to say it was post-war shabby building, because a lot of the post-war building was very poor. So much of it's coming down now, and But most of these seem to be quite reasonable little houses. Yeah, that was about that. And I was only there a year, and then I was asked by the World YWCA if I would go up to Jordan. There was Jordan at that time, was Jordan and Israel were sort of living vaguely in cahoots with a great big wall right down between them. And
what date would that have been?
I beg your pardon?
What date would that have been?
That was 1960. And because of the hoo-ha had been in 1948, they'd sort of come to some sort of modus vivendi, although it was very sort of suspicious on both sides. And the woman that I was working, the Arab that I was working with there in Jordan, Jerusalem, we could see from our office the house that she left with her breakfast on the table when the trouble came. And she had remained remarkably sane. She held the YWCA together, and that she was, I don't say she hated, but she was vituperative about it. And one had to be a little bit tactful about anything that one did. I know when I finally left, I wanted to go through Israel to find out what was happening in Israel. And it was about the only time we ever had a row, because she didn't want me to go. But I wanted to see what was on the other side of the wall, as well as what was on our side of the wall. But I worked with the YWCA in Jordan. I had nearly 2 years there.
What sort of work were you doing with the YWCA in Jordan?
Mainly with the refugee camps, particularly the ones round Jericho. Athaba Jabba was the big one there, which had started out as a UN refugee camp under tents, and gradually the standard little mud huts of the district went up. And it was, I don't know offhand how many people were there, but it was absolutely huge. And when we first moved in, the YM and the YW moved in almost immediately. The camp was set up, and we got our own compounds next to each other. And because, again, you see, there was no cohesion at all. The UN was doing its best, but it had got so much that we were not by any means the only camp. There was Calandia as well. And we got some buildings up, both YM and YW, we managed to get buildings up. And then we started programs. And we started by doing perfectly straightforward school teaching, primary up to the primary and secondary, because that appeared to be the great need. But gradually, as the UN took over, they started their own schools, and they started off with the primary one, and so we lost our primary school. And then they took over the secondaries as well. But by that time, we'd started on vocational training for that age group. So we were doing vocational training with handicrafts, making creche dolls out of wire, and I've got some of those somewhere, but I use them every year. Creche dolls out of wire and old stockings and stuffed them and dressed them properly with Palestinian clothes. They were only about a foot high, but we sold them all over the world, and they brought in a good income. So that, and then we did quite a lot of home economics. But of course, the thing was that we were girls, and we had a 6-foot wall right round us, because no parent would have allowed a girl to come into us if and do things in and out of compound if they weren't properly protected. But it was interesting because the young men began to realise that our girls were getting a very good housewife marriage sort of training, and we almost had a queue outside of young men waiting for our girls in order to marry them. But what happened was that we suddenly discovered that because the UN had taken over our schools, we got one big spare room, and we wondered what we were going to do with it. And vaguely somebody said, well, wouldn't it be a good idea if we could do something with the small children? And the next morning we had 6 small kids sitting in front of our front gate. The next day we had 50. The next day we had well over 100. And after that we couldn't take more. We hadn't got any teachers. We hadn't got any equipment. We had simply got a large room. And the kids, the parents wanted the kids to do something. We had a good reputation. And gradually we were able to build up a really good nursery school there. We managed to get some. We started with volunteer teachers, and finally we got some that we had to pay. But we got devoted teachers, and gradually we got the conditions better. We managed to get a whole lot of water sinks in and proper lavatories and that kind of thing. And we had baby shows. We had a baby show for the parents, but we only had one because it caused so much strife that we didn't dare have another one. But the thing that amazed me, and this has amazed me literally all over the world, is that those parents were coming, those women who brought their babies in, were coming out of mud huts. Every year that before the rains, the mud always had to be renewed, and they were coming out of mud huts. They probably had half a dozen children because there wasn't anything else to do except in those camps except their babies, and they were immaculate. Their children were so clean. The kids' clothes were, the baby's clothes were clean. The parents' clothes. And I was always absolutely astonished at how wonderfully clean they came out. And I found this with practically every country I've been in, that what comes out of those parts, whether it's Africa or Far East or Middle East, that they do try to keep their own dignity. And I think it's very important.
Who were the teachers?
Or our Arabs.
Were they?
Our Arabs.
Could you communicate with them, Lila?
Well, it didn't take long. I mean, the thing is, with any of the countries that I've worked in, it's quite easy to pick up quite quickly a working vocabulary of what you're doing. I never had time to bother with grammar and going right through it from the beginning. But I could nearly always, quite quickly, pick up a working vocabulary and communicate on what we were doing quite well. Whether it was Arabic or Malay or Korean or even Gar in West Africa, you could just. You couldn't talk. Have an educated discussion about books or music or something, but about what you were doing, you could cope with. And of course, it did help. There was no doubt about it. If you could communicate, we did have English classes, and we had one very good elderly woman who had been right through all the troubles and everything, and she was very sympathetic. She dealt very well with both her staff and the children. Mary Hishmi. She was excellent. But what we did do while we were there, while I was there, we sent a youngster called Katie DeVar, who was a very promising, young, bright young woman, And we sent her, I think she went to Swansea. We nearly always sent everybody to Swansea because Swansea had a very good social services sort of course there. And she went there, and I was back in Jerusalem at the end of 99. And Katie is now running the whole of our refugee program out there, which when you get something like that, it's worthwhile.
That contrasts with your Korean young woman you sent back and stayed in the States.
Never came back. Katie's made a very good job of it, and it was very nice to see her again. And I've been back to Jerusalem. I don't know how many times since I was there about nearly 2 years in 60-61, and while I was there, we got quite a lot done actually, because we'd got a ghastly little house in Jerusalem, which was all that we had for the YWCA there, trying to run the programs, and a dreadful little house. And we managed to find a decent piece of building where we could run home economics classes for girls in Jerusalem rather than the ones in refugee camps. And we also got the foundations done for an enormous hostel come training centre for the young Arab girls and various things. The proceedings for that went very well until we discovered that the same lawyer was dealing with us and with the people that we were trying to get the land from. That we did cause complications, but we got that one sorted out. But I've been back to Jerusalem, and then of course we got the 66 Six Days War, and I was in Kenya at the time. But I was very much closely in touch with what was going on, and as soon as I could, I went back to see what was happening, and I've been back a number of times since. By that time, of course, Israel had taken over a great deal of Jordan, and so the Palestinians, the Jordanians, whatever, I'm never very clear which is which now, they were beginning to feel the Israeli pinch. Because the Israelis have gradually taken over the whole of the situation there. And it has just got progressively worse. I was there 2 years ago, and I went into one of the refugee camps where it had been a refugee camp long enough for it to be proper buildings. And a proper community had built up, and a lot of the men had got their own occupations. And the Israelis had moved in that area, and they had taken over the houses, and they'd closed every room in every house except one room, and they boarded them up. And they went round regularly to see that the boards had not been taken down. And the woman that I went to see, Katie took me to see her, and she had five sons, and four of them were in Israeli jails. The fifth one, who was much smaller, I think she'd more or less threatened to hit one of the Israelis on the head if they took the small one. But there was much more hatred between them now, I think, than there was even after the breakup in 66. Everything has tightened up so much. The Jericho, you see, the Jericho people, the Jericho farmers, who'd been growing fruit and vegetables, the Arabs, for donkey's years. Their big market was Jerusalem. Well, now they're not allowed into Jerusalem. They can set up their stalls on the outskirts, but where they used to come into the shops and sell them in the shops, they're not allowed to go in. Which is not the industry down there for six anyway. Until I saw what was going on, I'd always thought a settlement was much the same as we've had settlements in this country, a little group of huts or houses on somewhere or other. But a settlement in Israel is something about the size of Sheffield. I mean, they are enormous, and they're absolutely everywhere. And the thing that horrified me this last time, when I was there last year, was that whereas when they first went, when the Israelis first began to take over all that area and to ring Jerusalem with settlements, they had built up so that there were flats and flats and flats and flats building up. But now they are beginning to take one-story houses, which is taking up much, much, much more room. And they are squeezing what is left of the Arabs in Jerusalem very, very hard. There's no doubt about it. This last time when I was there, I went out to Bethlehem to see what, because one always goes to Bethlehem to see what's happening. And I couldn't get back into Jerusalem without changing my taxi, because I was in an Arab taxi in Bethlehem. But in order to get back into Jerusalem, I had to change on the outskirts into an Israeli taxi to take me into Jerusalem. And gradually, the entry for Palestinians or Jordanians into Jerusalem is getting more and more and more difficult. When I was there a few years ago, I remember I had to get a pass to get into somewhere. And you see, it sounds wonderful for the outer world to say that Ramallah is now under its own control, Gaza is now under its own control, Hebron is now under its own control. But if you've got a ring of Israeli guns all around the village, I mean, what's the good of having a free village? I am very pro-Arab. I mean, there's no doubt about it, I am pro-Arab. But what I have felt the last two or three times that I've been in the area is I've been terribly, terribly sorry for the young Israelis, because they are now probably two generations from the Holocaust. Their parents, and certainly their grandparents, had been through it in Europe, wherever. But the young Israelis are growing up with a wall of hatred all the way around them. And I did feel most terribly sorry for them. I don't condone what they do, but I do feel that they have got a very difficult situation, the young ones have. But as against that, you see, I've had quite a lot to do with Lebanon, and I was in and out of Lebanon when all the Lebanese troubles were on, and I've seen the Israelis trying to take over Lebanon, and they got as far as Beirut, but they didn't get back. They haven't got. But I think that the problem there is that they want Beirut, which is the port, you see. It's a very good port, and Lebanon's a good country, and there's always conflict there. I was in Lebanon back in the 70s, I suppose, I was in bed one night and a bullet went under my bed. And if I was having a meeting, there would be crunches in the distance, and my meeting would dissolve because everybody would go off to see if it was their houses that had been blown up. Mm. And I was down in Tyre. I went down to Tyre to see, which is almost on the border, and I went down there to see because we'd got some very good nursery schools down there that really were a howling success, and I went down to see them and see if there was anything that we could do in the way of equipment and so on to help them out. And 6 days after I was there, Tyre was flattened. And our nursery schools just disappeared. Our nursery schools just went. And as far as I know, they've had nothing. That's still an almost no-go area down there.
Would your nursery schools have been for the Palestinians in Lebanon? All this would be related to the Palestinians.
Palestinians or Lebanese, because it all got so mixed up, you didn't know which was which after a bit. But it was, again, it was conflict all the time. And
when you were there in the 1960s, you know, this would have been, what, 12 years after the partition, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
And
the
the partition was still holding. It wasn't safe anywhere in the country, in Jordan, to go close to the Israeli border. It wasn't a no-go land, but it was almost a no-go land because there was always a possibility that you might get shot at because it was tense along the border. But at least the Israelis were on one side and the Jordanians were on the other side. And then after 1966, the Israelis took over and they just pushed the Jordanians out. And until they became Palestinians rather than Jordanians. And there are still quite a lot of them in the country, in Israel, but of course they're very second-class citizens. They're not supposed to be. The publicity says that it's all wonderful, but they're very second-class citizens. And it's just a trouble spot waiting for an eruption. And the one of the big problems, of course, is going to be water, because the Israelis have taken so much out of the Jordan Valley that anything sunk in the way of wells in the Jordan Valley brings up salt now. It's almost all the deep wells now are salt. The Dead Sea is drying up. I've seen that when I was there last year. I mean, there were peninsulas and little islands in the Dead Sea that were certainly not there 50 years ago. I mean, it's just drying up. And it was...
I suppose also the water supplies in the Lebanon might be a factor. The Litani River, for instance.
Yes. They've got... Mount, what is it, Hebron? No, Mount, beginning something with H up there anyway, which does get quite a bit of snow in the winter, and so the top half isn't so bad. The Lebanese bit isn't so bad for water, but the big problem now is the Jordanian, Syrian, Israeli borders, which are almost sort of coincide up at the top there, where the water supply is just disappearing.
And I suppose the Golan comes into that because
Golan
water's there, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm.
And it's. And of course, as you see, the Israelis, all their new settlements are using water all the time. And it's water that is being dragged out of the ground. They are doing quite a lot, given their due, they're doing quite a lot on desalinification down by the coastline. They are doing quite a bit on that. But if there's a shortage of water ever, it's the Palestinians, the Jordanians, who ultimately suffer. And the Israelis are still managing to get water. When I was there in 60, if you wanted to build a house, you had to build a tank under the house before you built a house on top. So that you got a supply, when the rains did come, you got a supply of water.